Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Talk Energy with ES Europe. Today our show is Caleb Wall, Vice President, Global Energy Technology and Solutions at Macquarie Group. Caleb, could you give a quick self-introduction?
Certainly, and thank you. It's a pleasure to be on and to share some views. And hello everybody. My name is Caleb Bois. I'm currently with Macquarie Group, where we focus on investment in the energy transition and primarily in emerging energy technologies. As Ronnie mentioned, prior to that, I was with Lockheed Martin for a number of years, both making early stage energy technology investments at the corporate level and then leading analytics for a grid scale energy storage startup. And before that, did my graduate studies at MIT. So excited to participate and look forward to the conversation.
Thank you, Caleb. I know you have a broad experience related to energy investment, technical analytics, but also on different fronts of energy. But today, I want to focus our topic exclusively on energy storage. And my first question to you is, you know, based on your experience, what are some of the biggest trends and drivers in the field of energy storage?
Yeah, certainly. So I think there's two main areas. As they take kind of a high level view at, you know, the energy transition broadly, and we'll kind of define that as kind of the pathway we're on right now and the journey of transitioning from carbon intensive fossil free energy resources to carbon free. For me, I largely kind of view the last couple of decades as one which you're really striving to get sources of renewable generation, carbon-free generation, at cost parity or cheaper than traditional carbon generators, carbon-intensive generation. And that's largely, you know, been accomplished. We've seen significant cost reduction and performance improvements in solar and wind. And for me, kind of the second part of energy transition now really comes to focus on grid flexibility, reliability, and how do you actually power the electric grid operationally in a reliable manner with all these intermittent, you know, renewable assets. And so in that piece of the energy transition, the grid really starts valuing flexibility as a way to kind of balance your generation, your supply and load in real time. And that's where you really see the value that assets like energy storage can bring in addressing flexibility. In that area, there's really kind of two main drivers. You're seeing an increase in investment opportunity in grid scale batteries. The costs come way, way down. You're starting to see places where now you can build grid-scale battery projects in markets, and they have attractive economics and returns. You're also seeing the emergence of lots of batteries on the distribution scale, you know, being built behind customer meters, helping to provide reliability and help customers manage their energy costs. And all this, once again, enabled by just how much the cost of batteries and storage has come down. So I'd see those as some of the major trends, major drivers in energy storage right now.
All right, so energy transition and grid flexibility. And I want to follow up on one sub-point you mentioned about the grid-scale grid-scale battery, because there seems to be like a misconception about the role grid-scale battery could play in, you know, securing the power supply. So could you tell us, like, where exactly does grid scale battery comes in? What kind of role does it play in making our grid secure and improving the, you know, the reliability? Because just to provide one more example, why I'm asking this is I've seen a recent report saying the the total cumulative grid scale battery combined globally can only power, like, you know, the daily consumption of maybe just 1 or 2 hours. So that make people think that what's the role of grid-scale battery?
Yeah, and for that you really have to take a system level view. And you also have to look at what specific problems are batteries solving on the grid or intended to solve, and what are the key applications. And so, first off, batteries are energy limited resources. They only have a finite of storage capacity. And decisions around, how much capacity you have behind a battery and how long it can charge or discharge for. Those decisions are driven around what it's going to be used for and kind of what the costs and revenue associated with that is. I think when you kind of break down the application space, you really kind of focus on what can shorter duration batteries problems can those types of technology solve, and then kind of move on to longer. Right now, what you're seeing a lot of is because of how quickly and how fast responsive a battery can be on the grid, kind of the initial grid scale application you're seeing a lot of is batteries providing service for frequency regulation. And so this is helping to meet that real time, matching of generation and supply, and helping grid operators do that in real time at a very fast frequency. And so for that, the size of regulation requirement, compared to an overall market is maybe 5%. So you don't need a ton of batteries to kind of help provide that type of application. When you start looking to eventually where we're likely wanting to go, which is bulk time shifting of renewable generation, or having enough storage capacity to provide backup power, peaking capacity. Then you start looking at, significantly higher volume, and you do need, costs to probably come down to where they currently are. So I kind of think of it as an aperture, right now with where the cost of batteries are and with where we are in the deployment of renewables in the grid and what sorts of requirements there are. The aperture starts out smaller. There's certain applications that make sense at certain cost points, where projects are economical, and as costs continue to go down and as renewables continue to increase and penetrate the grid, that aperture continues to open, and more problems that batteries can solve and then do so economically, continues to grow.
All right, no problem. I just want to, put this into context. And I think what you explained is really clear. But just to put this into context for people who are not so familiar with the grid system, for example, for the power outage in Texas earlier this year, for example, would there be a role for grid scale battery, in either recovering the grid or in other areas?
Yeah, so that particular case, and I think you're talking about the large freeze, the deep freeze that happened in Texas, where a number of natural gas pipes actually got frozen, and gas facilities got frozen cold below the point which they were able to operate, and that ended up lasting for about an 8 to 9 day period. That type of problem would be very hard for battery to solve. Just because you would have to have that long of, storage capacity, retained to dispatch for that period of time. Problems that batteries, would be good at solving are, say, at a residential or a commercial level where, perhaps you're in California where they need to power down the grid for, a few hours during some peak periods to reduce the probability of wildfires. And this is something I being from the Bay Area, living in the Bay Area, I'm pretty familiar with. If you're able to have batteries provide even a couple hours or, 4 hours of backup capacity that can provide resiliency, localized resiliency to individual customers. it's likely for kind of shorter duration needs, you know, batteries will play a strong role, at least with the technology now. You likely have to have different type of technology that can provide, you know, days, you know, weeks, even months of stored energy capacity to start kind of addressing these really long-term reliability issues.
That's very interesting. Actually, as we are speaking, you know, there's a hot topic going on, which is the outage for probably maybe the data centers for Facebook, and Instagram, and WhatsApp. That's why we cannot use their services at the moment. Maybe it's only in the UK, but I just want to ask this question one more time about these, you know, data center power supply security. You know, it could just be a few hours. You could maximum 1 or 2 days. Otherwise, the cost would be too much. But what sort of energy storage would be ideal, you know, or more appropriate for data center power supply security?
Yeah, so the most common application, the one that you have right now, is really a much, much shorter duration, uninterrupted power supply energy storage. And so really what that's intended to do is cover, you know, the 3 minutes or so that it takes for a backup diesel genset to kind of ramp up and provide, you know, kind of an islanding capability to keep a data center running in the event of a grid outage. So that currently is a requirement. The role a battery could play, or whether you'd start looking to have a battery kind of provide a longer backup role, you know, is really going to be a function of cost. And so what you really have to think about is, you know, if I only anticipate, a disruption in grid power, you know, a handful of times or a couple times a year, I have to kind of compare the cost of a battery, which could be very expensive, you know, upfront capex versus the capex and opex of a backup generator. Right now, if it's under very low utilization, you're not having to run that generator that much. It's probably cheaper to use a generator and fuel, even if the fuel costs are high. So it's for our current technologies, you're probably not yet at that point for which, you know, a battery would be a good solution for multi-hour backup for an entire data center. But technology keeps improving and costs continue to come down.
All right. Thank you very much. And I want to keep our conversation on this topic going because it kind of covers the rest of the questions as well, which is I heard like some companies are trying to use hydrogen for their data center backup power as well. Do you consider hydrogen to be, you know, a good solution for this specific application, and also the prospect of hydrogen as a form of energy storage in general?
Yeah, so I haven't looked as deeply on hydrogen, so I'm probably not as qualified to kind of comment on that, you know, compared to energy storage and battery technologies. What I can say is, you know, there's within the industry, I think there's a growing focus on hydrogen, perhaps more so than we've seen in many recent years, you know, particularly the last year and a half. There's been significantly more focus on hydrogen and the opportunity for hydrogen to play a large role in the clean energy economy. I think it's at a place where, in order to have widespread application for energy, both heat and electricity generation, you certainly do need to see kind of costs continue to come down from where they are at today. Where I think you are seeing inroads is, you know, hydrogen as a feedstock to commodity chemicals or the types of chemicals. The most well-known, you kind of at the moment, is hydrogen as a feedstock to ammonia, which then goes into, you know, manufacturing fertilizers. And so non-combustible uses of hydrogen kind of as a feedstock, you know, chemical, I think will likely be the place that you'll see the earliest applications. And other than that, you know, I think we certainly an area rich for research for us to continue to kind of figure out how we can improve the the techno-economics and get them to a good cost point.
Yeah, of course, the application scenario of hydrogen is important, and also another thing that's also important is the source or the nature, the color of hydrogen. So now we have green hydrogen, which is produced from renewable power, and also the kind of like the gray hydrogen, or blue hydrogen that's produced from conventional hydrogen production, like SMR, together with carbon capture or something. Do you consider blue hydrogen as a long-term solution, or do you consider this as something that's not going to grow very significantly?
Yeah, I think once again, I'm probably not as qualified as others to speak on this topic. I think a lot of the opportunity around these technologies will likely be driven by how policy is designed and how policy can incentivize certain solutions. I think there's a lot of momentum right now to get strong incentives around both green hydrogen, blue hydrogen, and how those incentives are designed and kind of what the impact of those incentives are on kind of projects that one would want to go out and build will likely be a pretty major factor in seeing kind of which technologies end up kind of growing and getting adopted. I probably say that at the high level. I think that's true of energy, any technology right now, to the extent that there are certain policies that can help some of these early stage technologies or technologies that aren't quite, maybe at a cost point where they need to be, that will certainly play a major factor in how quickly they're able to kind of adopt and scale.
And I now want to move on to a more general question about, say, consider you have experience in doing research, energy research at MIT, but also working at the industry and as an investor in the energy sector. And I'm sure you've interacted with the regulatory bodies as well. So overall, which sector do you consider to have the biggest bottleneck for the development of energy storage technologies? If you feel this is too general, you could narrow it down to maybe one particular technology, say battery.
I think 10 years ago, I would have said cost. There's a lot of things that one would have wanted to have a battery or any type of storage, chemical or otherwise, way of storing storing energy capacity. A decade ago, 5 years ago, even there really weren't a lot of technology options available that were at an attractive enough cost point, for storage really proliferate the market, kind of at a grid scale. What you've seen is because of scaling of lithium ion chemistries in particular for EV applications, the ancillary benefit of that has been, the significant reduction in cost of lithium ion batteries that now are at a cost point where you can put them in grid applications and have attractive, economics. So 5 to 10 years ago, I would have said cost. I don't think that's the challenge now. I think right now, a lot of it is around getting comfort with, batteries as kind of a new asset class that can attract investment, from large institutional investors, and for which you can kind of get comfortable with the type of investment that it is. Lots of batteries, increasingly traditional renewables, wind, solar, face an increasing amount of market risk. So you're making a commitment to invest a whole lot of money to build this asset up front, but then you don't necessarily have a guarantee or any level of certainty around the type of revenue if it's, you know, wholly going to be participating in wholesale energy markets. And so I think there's a lot to be thought about in, you know, how do you create appropriate market mechanisms to incentivize kind of competition in the space, but also, you know, lower the risk on capital that is being put to work, you know, as we build out, you know, these assets. And so things you could think about, you know, if you build batteries, for example, in Texas, you're kind of building those batteries to go after these very high volatile energy events, you know, scarcity pricing is what's called. And you'll see this back in February, energy in Texas got up to $9,000 a megawatt hour, you know, for a sustained period. That's very uncommon, but, you know, the way that market's designed is to have, you know, these very high price events, these scarce pricing events when your reserve margin gets quite low to incentivize kind of investment in that space. Well, is having 50 of these $9,000 per megawatt hour events a year a good way to kind of incentivize building out of energy storage? Or is, you know, something like a capacity mechanism where you're generating, you're paying for these batteries, you know, through kind of a fixed capacity payment, you know, like the resource adequacy program you have in California. I think there's a lot of kind of discussion debate because the investment in these types of assets does look quite a bit different than, you know, say a natural gas, you know, peaker plant or combined cycle turbine. You know, these are almost entirely upfront capital, you know, CapEx investments. There's very little OpEx. There's no fuel cost, you know, compared to, you know, those types of thermal plants where, yes, there's some upfront, you know, CapEx, obviously, but a lot of the decision-making around how to participate in the market comes down to fuel costs and operational costs. And so I think it's likely you're going to see evolution in how we think about what the right market structures are for creating the right incentives, you know, kind of around these asset classes, you know, as we really try to scale and kind of get to a point where we're operating our energy markets and we're powering them with, you know, these assets that fundamentally are dependent on an energy supply that's unpredictable. You know, you're basically betting on the weather, whether it's going to be sunny or windy. And then, you know, batteries that are basically make their money off of volatility and solving for the real-time matching of electrons, you know, from a supply and demand standpoint.
That's a really good answer. And one other question that we received from our audience is that, do you consider, say, the distributed energy storage from electric vehicles to be a, you know, it's going to play a major role in solving any challenge?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's that capacity can be used in many ways, and how it's used and, you know, what the most effective way to use it, you know, is probably a big question. There is no question that if one were to try to, you know, power the majority of current transportation with electric vehicles, that the load created and the energy requirements created behind, you know, shifting all of that fuel source from, you know, petroleum to electricity is going to have a massive impact. And that is in many ways shapeable load. And so how you design incentives and how you kind of create markets around now this new very shapeable load, which is basically driven off of when people decide to charge their vehicles, you know, I think has a very significant role. And so that can be done in a simple way where it's just creating incentives when I charge or discharge my batteries, you know, which is, you know, a little bit more passive, all the way up to, you know, we've certainly seen a lot of vehicle-to-grid technologies where we've actually seen pilots, you know, demonstrating the ability to use a vehicle battery connected to a bidirectional inverter to respond to a system operator's, you know, AGC signal to use that battery to provide regulation services, you know, with like a 6-second response time. So you have a very wide, broad spectrum in how that load, how that energy storage capacity, you know, sitting in the vehicle can be used. But there's certainly no question that is going to be a significant lever as far as on the load side and how we match supply and demand of electricity on the grid.
All right, thank you very much. And I think I've asked a lot of questions on energy storage, and I now want to steer our direction to a few career-related questions, because many of our audience are young students who are looking for jobs or developing their career. And the very first question is specific to your background, which is, how do you compare, your experience as an investor at Macquarie, or just in general, as compared with your experience in academia and your experience in manufacturing industry?
You're thinking very carefully, and you're trying to ask a lot of similar questions, all in the space. And fundamentally, that comes down to how can you address and solve the energy transition problem? I think the difference really is, what piece of that problem are you most focused on, and what unique things about the piece of the problem you're focused on are most important for solving that piece. I think in academia, you have a much more flexibility. You're not worried about, generating revenue, generating profit, running a profitable business. You have a lot more flexibility and freedom to kind of think big picture around problems and to explore very, very creative solutions. That may otherwise be seen as too risky or too tangential, to a business, than what you may be able to kind of look at, either working in industry, for a product, manufacturer, for example, like I was doing at Lockheed, or actually investing in projects or companies or technology, as I do now. So academia certainly gives you that kind of perspective. I think, on the flip side, academia probably gives you less of kind of a boots on the ground or kind of a connection to a lot of the real world considerations that are going on in real time. Usually by the time something ends up in an academic journal, it's, a couple of years out of date already. So I think, at least being in industry, being in investment, you kind of get to see things the front line, you're on the second row, the 50-yard line, kind of seeing things built out. Industry, I think a lot of the focus, you get to kind of think about solutioning, at least, from my work at Lockheed, from a technology perspective, what sort of technologies and how do you productize these technologies? You're thinking about how do I ramp up manufacturing? How do I work my supply chain? It's very operational. It's very much focused on execution and delivery. And then certainly on the investment side, you're wanting to make good choices around efficient deployment of capital and making sure that capital is going towards assets that are going to be valuable and have impact. I think there's a lot of similarity. I think there's value in all those areas of focusing on the energy transition in a multidisciplinary way, and that's something that I think has definitely been the value for me. Even when I was in grad school taking courses in nuclear physics, I took the full finance track at our business school, just to understand what project finance looks like and how I think about investing in these assets we're trying to build. When I was at Lockheed, there's a big focus on cost. What does the product that we're going to sell need to cost in order to be competitive in the market? How do we design to that cost? Fundamentally, the energy transition is a design to cost exercise. You're trying to disrupt one of the most competitive commodity markets in the world. That say often there are no Louis Vuitton electrons. Nobody wants to pay for a premium, you know, electron. That they're all the same. How, as we're looking to innovate, and when I look at kind of that overall innovation space, it requires technology, yes, but it also requires innovative financial solutions, you know, structured finance, you know, product, you know, design. It requires, you know, from a technology innovation standpoint, since this fundamentally costs a design, you know, deep thinking about what my technology will cost and how I can ramp up, you know, manufacturing and so forth in a way that I'm competitive in that market. And so you really need to be thinking about those techno-economics along with, you know, your basic R&D and research as you're going through that process. And so I think there's value regardless if you want to be in academia, if you want to be in industry, if you want to be in finance, to having a multidisciplinary understanding of the space. You know, understanding power market fundamentals, understanding basic project finance, understanding, you know, supply chain, how you ramp up kind of manufacturing, you know, in order to truly understand what kind of solutions are needed and how would they be part of the transition. So I'm a strong proponent of as multidisciplinary as broad of you know, education and kind of background as one can get.
Thank you. I totally agree with you. I think this is a smart approach as well. And just on that point, you mentioned, you know, it's important to choose which specific problem you want to solve. And many of the audience will have like entrepreneur mindset. You know, if they were to, you know, start up a new business in the energy sector, do you have a, you know, recommendation for a subsector? But skip this question if you don't want to give out the secrets.
Yeah, I mean, the advice I give is look very, very carefully at what other people have already tried to do. There's been a significant amount of innovation by really, really smart people that, for whatever reason, may have been successful or not. And I think it's underappreciated just how deep and just how far a lot of kind of innovators have gotten in the space. And so I think instead of just starting with the whiteboard, if your approach to innovation is, you know, I'm going to go in a room, sit in front of a whiteboard, you know, start throwing out ideas and everything, and kind of I'm doing that process of innovation in a bubble. I think you're probably approaching it the right way. You know, I would suggest go out, like look at all the startups look out there, look at the ones that have been around a while that have had a hard time growing, look at the ones that have been highly successful. Learn as much as you can from what you're seeing, you know, being pursued in the market, and then try to find that niche, or then try to find that differentiation of where you think you've seen something work well applied to kind of one segment that you think might work well applied to another, where you've seen things tried multiple times that just haven't worked out. You know, learn as much as you can from what a lot of smart people have done, and loop that into kind of your process of thinking about where you could, you know, be innovative and be entrepreneurial in the space would probably be my suggestion.
Sounds good. And one last question about today, which is, what's your maybe top three general career development advice?
I think I'd keep it fairly high level. Actually, I wouldn't make it too specific. I think, you know, at a high level, remain intellectually curious. Prioritize, you know, continuing to learn and grow and spend time on it. You know, really identify the types of things you're good at and focus on those. Definitely try to branch out, but, you know, at this stage in my career, I've come to notice that as I've worked on projects or worked with other teams, I tend to spend my time or migrate, you know, to certain certain things, contributions on that team that I do very well at, and there's other things that I can do, but it's probably not my strong suit. So I would say definitely get to know what your strong suits are and play to your strengths. And while you're doing that, you know, continue to kind of balance that with working on and try to improve in the areas that you're not.
Okay, thank you very much. I think that concludes our interview today. Thank you very much for coming.